You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen, and I've been pretty stressed at work lately. I've got deadlines looming, I'm finishing my days later and later, and even when I finish work, it's all still on my mind. The line between my professional life and my personal life is getting kind of blurry. But I can make the line a little clearer if I make the effort. I can turn off my phone, stop checking emails, I can take a day off. Not everyone has that luxury. This week, we have two stories of people who find themselves in a situation where the line between their professional life and their personal life is not only blurred, but erased, even on the weekends. This first story is about Jan Waddell, a former nurse. After years of observing discrimination against the HIV patients she treated, Jan contracted the virus herself and began experiencing stigma firsthand. Just a heads up if you're scared of needles, Jan contracted HIV via needle stick injury, and she describes how that happened in this story.
I was living in Perth, West Australia, and I was working as a phlebotomist for a private pathology company. I had quite a few AIDS patients on my books, and one particular young man used to come into the clinic, and I'd been seeing him for about 4 years, and he was quite a sick young man. So I took his blood. I think I rushed it too much, to be honest with you. And as I was getting rid of the syringe needle, the needle went in between my thumb and my forefinger. And of course, when I went to grab the needle to take it out, I grabbed the plunger. And that's when I felt the blood going in. My name is Jan Waddell. I'm 72 years old, and I've been living with HIV for 18 years now.
Jan was diagnosed on the 4th of April, 2002. Her first encounter with an HIV patient was two decades earlier. Back in 1982, she was working at a hospital in England and had recently finished her final nursing exams.
It was just a small town hospital. I think we probably had 80 beds or 100 beds, maybe. I remember his name. His name was Michael. I remember he smiled a lot, but he was very quiet because he was so weak. When I asked a question, he would just kind of nod and smile. They had a very kind of haunted look. None of us knew at the time he was an AIDS patient. We were just told that we had a patient who was extremely ill and extremely infectious.
There's only three ways to get HIV: unprotected sex, blood-to-blood contact, or from parent to child. With new medication, HIV-positive people can now have sex and conceive children without transmission. But in 1982, there was no treatment, and experts didn't know how the virus worked. The confusion led to Jan and the other nurses taking unnecessary precautions. Every time they entered the room of an HIV patient, they were told to wear a mask, goggles, and a PPE suit that covered their entire bodies.
And the only thing they could really see was our eyes. They had absolutely no idea who was looking after them. Walking in, looking like a spaceman, was just awful. But we thought at the time we were doing the right thing, you know, and it was out of fear and ignorance, I think.
Back then, they weren't even using the term HIV yet. They were calling it
gay-related immune deficiency, or gay cancer.
An epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
RIDS, gay-related infectious diseases.
Mysterious newly discovered disease, which affects mostly homosexual men.
As the 80s progressed, HIV became synonymous with fear and death. In one Australian public health advertisement, a grim reaper stands in a dimly lit bowling alley engulfed in mist.
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it.
The grim reaper hurls a giant ball towards a crowd of people lined up like bowling pins, knocking them all down. Then a pin setter sweeps away the dead bodies before lining up a new set of human targets.
But if not stopped, it could kill more Australians than World War II.
What do you remember about the public attitude towards people with HIV at the time?
The general attitude was they wanted nothing to do with them. They hated them. I actually lost quite a few friends back then.
What kind of things did you hear people say?
Oh, that they should be not allowed to live. They should herd them all up and put them on an island somewhere. Just horrible things, awful.
By the end of 1983, it was confirmed that HIV could not be transmitted through casual contact, like shaking hands or sharing drinks. But stigma and misconceptions about how it spread persisted. Shortly after her needle stick injury in 2002, Jan was admitted to a hospital in Perth, where after years of observing the stigma against others, she experienced it firsthand.
It was pretty awful. I had one nurse that was frightened to come near me. Whenever I rang the bell, she would stand at the end of the bed and then said, "I'll go and get somebody else." I needed her there and then, you know.
What was it that made you decide to start opening up to other people about your status?
It was because of a woman, actually. It's almost like she was stalking me in Perth. And it was because of her, really, that I came out. It was a woman who was in my art class. And I was in the ladies' toilet with my friend. And I was saying to my friend, you know, why is this happening? Why am I the only one that I know that's got HIV? And I didn't realise that she was in the toilet. And when she heard that, she went running out. And when I went back into the room, she was just yelling. She was telling the art teacher and the other ladies there not to let me touch their paints or their brushes because I was HIV positive. And I tried to talk to her. I said, "Look, let me explain." And she just went no and ran out. The next time was when I was in a shoe shop and I was trying on shoes. And I heard this woman tell the manager, "That woman's got AIDS. She shouldn't be allowed to try on shoes." And I turned around and there's that woman standing there. And probably about 3-4 weeks later, maybe, I was in my local grocery shop and the same thing. This woman was shouting at the manager, "Why is she touching the stuff? That woman has got AIDS." And I just thought, that's it. I've had enough of this. And I went home and I phoned the police. And that was it. I never heard from her again. And I got to thinking about things and I thought, this is how people are being treated all the time. This is just a one-off for me. People are being treated like this all the time. People need to know about this. And that's when I started telling my neighbours and my friends. Because of the way I was infected, I didn't really lose any friends. They're saying, "Oh, you know, you didn't deserve that because you were doing your job." And I'm like, well, nobody deserves this. Doesn't matter how they were infected. If you can understand what it's like for me living with it and supporting me, why can't you support these other people? And slowly, slowly, a lot of them came around to that way of thinking.
She was active on HIV support forums at the time and had heard stories about how stigma could lead to evictions, job loss, and even violence.
I knew so many people who had suffered badly because they're worried about how they were going to be treated. I felt though my position was different to theirs, whereas they felt that they had to hide and couldn't talk about it. I felt, well, I can. You know, let me help you with that, or let me be your voice.
Jan joined the Positive Speakers Bureau, an international network of trained HIV educators who raise awareness through public talks. Back in the 80s, a popular protest slogan was "Silence equals death." It critiqued the widespread indifference towards the number of gay men who were dying of AIDS-related illnesses. Thanks to medical breakthroughs, HIV is no longer a death sentence, but Jan thinks the slogan is still relevant. She talks about how fear of stigma can deter people from seeking treatment or getting tested in the first place. Jan lives in New Zealand now, where she gives guest lectures to medical students. In one of her PowerPoint presentations, the final slide says, "Speak out, because silence still equals death." Her first ever lecture was back in 2006.
I had never spoken in public before, and I walked into this auditorium in Dunedin Hospital, and there was 200 students there. I almost died, and I drank a lot of water because my mouth kept drying up. I was so, so nervous, and it kind of started there. because the students were so amazing. And they all came up to me and thanked me for being there, that I thought, this is not a bad way of getting through to people. I got a little bit more confident over time. I told them about the woman that was stalking me and about how that young nurse treated me. I get a lot of feedback about how, oh, we didn't know it was that bad, or we would never do that. I've had talks with especially the young nurses, like, you know, second year nurses. I've had them come up and hug me. And I think, yeah, I have got through to them that it is okay to hug somebody with HIV.
That story was produced by Thomas Phillips. The supervising producer was Lee Robinson. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. Science journalist Bianca Nogrady has reported on bushfires before, but her professional and personal life suddenly collided when a bushfire arrived on her doorstep.
The moment that for me is just like seared in my gut was the morning of the 22nd, and the neighbour up the back rang, and I was at the swimming pool at the hotel with the kids, and she rang and the first thing she said was, "It's on your block." And I remember getting the kids in the lift to go back to the hotel room, and, you know, someone else was in the lift and looked at this guy and I said, "Our backyard's on fire." You know, it's funny, I remember that moment. I don't actually remember much of the rest of that day. I don't remember what happened.
Bushfires have long been a part of Bianca Nogrady's life.
I'm Bianca Nogrady. I'm a freelance science journalist. Write a lot about bushfires, write the occasional book, do the occasional bit of radio, and live in the Blue Mountains, the highly flammable but also very beautiful Blue Mountains.
Journalists are often asked to include the human element in their reporting, finding people to share their stories. 3 days before Christmas, standing by the hotel pool where she'd evacuated with her family, Bianca got a call.
A British, it might have been Sky in the UK, the TV news, TV station Sky, they were out here and reporting on the fires. And I think I must have spoken to her that day because I said, "We're going home tomorrow." And she said, "Oh, look, you know, can we be there when you get home? Can we actually film you coming back onto the block?" And I never got back to her. And I think that was my subconscious going, "That's a really bad idea," because I didn't know how we would feel when we got home. And thankfully she sensed that, or maybe something else came up, but they didn't follow through. We can actually, do you want to walk down the bottom?
Or, yeah, sure.
All right, so we've got to, it's a bit, just got to kind of watch where you walk. So these are one of my two beehives. So this was actually bulldozed around. You can sort of see this cleared space and see where they're pushed up, because they thought if it comes through this section here, it'd impact the beehives. So they
bulldozed. Bianca's house is made of concrete and steel, designed to withstand bushfires as much as possible. It's surrounded by Blue Mountain ash trees, strips of bark hang from the trunks like streamers.
So we got back on the 23rd, and I'm glad they went there, because I'll tell you what, driving into the driveway and having this kind of smouldering landscape as you drive up and seeing how close it came to the house, and you know, we all got out of the car and, you know, opened up the house so the kids could go in, and, you know, Phil and I just kind of walked around the block in silence, like, oh, wow, and, you know, things still smouldering and smoking.
When the fires threatened the house, Bianca had already evacuated with her family, so it was her neighbours and the Rural Fire Service, the RFS, who defended the property. There's a striking photo Bianca took. I can't get out of my head. a ring of black against green grass that stops abruptly meters from our house. Bianca and her family spent Christmas Eve and the following days putting out spot fires.
For weeks after that, we would still, like literally weeks, there was still stuff that would start smouldering because it would be piles of burn stuff or something inside a trunk and it would just suddenly start smoking again. And so, you know, we patrolled the block every, probably once or twice a day. And that was the other thing after the fire came through. A lot of people were warned. It's like, don't go walking through the bush because there are so many trees that are dead that it will drop limbs without warning. Oh. And so, yeah, occasionally we'd be sort of sitting in the house, the windows open, and you just hear this huge crash. It's like, oh, there goes a tree.
Australia welcomed 2020 with record heat. The skies red and air thick with smoke. Most of the East Coast was still burning. And Bianca, who had been sharing her experiences of evacuation and the bushfire threat online, was being contacted by media outlets around the world for interviews and for work.
I knew the experts, you know, across this space fairly well. I had that background understanding of the, you know, the general scientific landscape with respect to bushfires, and not just scientific landscape, but also the kind of the political landscape and the regulatory landscape. And so all of those things meant that when I had to write these stories, you know, very quickly, I had those resources at my disposal.
The first weeks of January were some of the most intense periods of Bianca's life.
But, you know, there were still helicopters going around. You know, every now and then you'd hear sirens and, you know, I was twitchy with sirens, helicopters and sirens for a long, long time. Everybody was, because we just lived with it for such a long time. And even the huge, you know, DC-10 flying overhead, the water bombing aeroplane, with a big pink belly going overhead, you know, that was the part of the soundscape of that summer. You know, I was pretty wrecked at the end of it, and I remember I didn't really want to cook much, so I just cooked this big chicken up at the start of it, and then I basically just lived off that for the rest of the time. And yeah, I just wrote.
Bianca shut herself away, writing 6 stories in 10 days.
You know, I'd wake up having these panic dreams, and it was exhausting.
She was out of her comfort zone. Editors wanted her experience to be part of the story.
And I think I was a little bit more okay with it because I recognised that my story was the story of so many other people. So I kind of felt like I was, representing all of those Australians who were going through that same process. But, you know, and I remember kind of writing and then I'd cry and then I'd write some more and then I'd cry and then it's like, okay. But I recognise I was also processing.
In an opinion piece for USA Today, Bianca's words are branded into my mind, bringing back memories of ash and black leaves falling from the sky.
We have evacuated from our house in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney twice already in Australia's bushfire season, and it's not even halfway through summer. After the second time, just a few weeks ago in December, we returned to a scorched block of land. These are the things that so many Australians are learning amid flame and smoke and fear. The bushfires that have confronted this nation and continue to do so are so beyond our comprehension that even the word unprecedented seems hopelessly inadequate.
It's not something I'd want to do on a regular basis because, firstly, I don't think my opinion matters in the context of me being a science journalist. You know, that's not my job. And, you know, I'm happy to be highly opinionated, you know, with friends and family and on social media. But as a journalist, my opinion, I think generally I try to, as much as I can, keep that out of a story. Whereas here, because I was part of the story, I was able to put my opinion and my feelings and my emotion into the stories, which I did. So recognizing that, and then recognizing that as a journalist, if you're reporting on it, you don't have the luxury then of backing away from that subject matter. You are diving straight back into it and you are reliving it. You are kind of re-exploring the emotions and you're kind of re-traumatizing yourself by doing that. And I think what I learned from this process was just how big a cost that takes and exacts from, you know, from me as a journalist to have to do that.
An unexpected reader shared it on their socials.
You know, that got shared by Leonardo DiCaprio on his Facebook page, which I didn't find out until like a month later, and someone said, oh, yeah, Leo shared it. It was like, oh, squee.
In late January, rain fell in the Blue Mountains.
Kind of weird looking at all this, but this was just black. This was all ash. You know, you walk through it and it was just puffs of ash and it was crunchy and, you know, I find it extraordinary to see it come back like this. It's, remembering what it looked like is really, really something.
On the trunks of the mountain ash, Bianca points out new growth.
But yeah, I love the way that these gums regrow, you know, this kind of epicormic growth. So they have all those buds that are below the bark and so they're triggered by fire and by heat. That was really cute actually, was just seeing, because when they first come out, they're really red. So they're kind of the colour of the twigs. And so you get this black burnt bark with this brilliant red, or kind of a coral red almost, just erupting out of it. And it was just beautiful. I took so many photos, like close-up photos of that regrowth.
Australia is approaching a year since that season of bushfire began.
I'm furious. I'm incandescently angry about the recalcitrance and the stubbornness and the corruption and the ideological zealotry that has dominated Australian politics and has put us in a situation where we are not pulling our weight with respect to climate change.
The little wrens, I don't know exactly what kind, like fairy wren maybe, or silver eyes or something.
Actually, it's funny because my son sounds just like the wood duck sometimes when he's in bed. He goes, Mom! Mom! And he sounds exactly like the ducks. So there's been situations where it's like, is that a duck or my son? I can't quite tell because we get tons of these ducks. Like,
that story was produced by Ivy Shee. Sarah Mashman was the supervising producer. Bianca recommends the DART Centre for Journalism and Trauma, which has excellent mental health advice and resources for journalists reporting on difficult topics, including natural disasters. If that's you, then visit dartcentre.org. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Julian Wan. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell has finished up in her role as Victorian State Coordinator. She'll stay on the All the Best team as a supervising producer. Thanks, Jordan, for everything you've done for the show over the past 2 years. We'd like to welcome Mel Chun as our new Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Matilda Fay and Angela Moran are our social media producers, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find more episodes by searching for All the Best. wherever you get your podcasts.